Coming up on Tech News Weekly, it's me, Jason Howell, my co-host, Micah Sargent, and we've got a show for you that's at least 50% generated by artificial intelligence. So first, we talk with Jared Newman from Fast Company about how cable internet is getting some serious competition with 5G. It's starting to affect its bottom line. Also, Tate Ryan Mosley from MIT Technology Review talks all about beauty filters online and the many bans that they're facing on social media and why that is. Then both Micah and my story of the week have to do with different aspects of AI-generated creativity. I talk about an AI system that actually won a digital art competition at a state fair. And is that fair? We're going to talk about that. Also, Micah shares his firsthand experience with Google's AI Test Kitchen. We give it a live demo on the show. That's all coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 250, recorded Thursday, September 1st, 2022. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Secure your family's online activity and unlock tons of new shows by visiting expressvpn.com/TNW. Take back your online privacy today and use our link to get 3 extra months free with a 1-year package.
And by Infrascale. Infrascale delivers industry-leading data protection through backup and disaster recovery. Visit infrascale.com/twit to sign up for a free demo and see how Infrascale protects your business today.
And by IT Pro TV. Are you looking to break into the world of IT? Get the introduction you need with IT Pro TV. Get 30% off when you sign up at itpro.tv/TNW and make sure and use code TNW30 at checkout.
Hello and welcome back to Tech News Weekly, or perhaps welcome for the first time if you are a new listener. Thank you for being here with us. There's a seat just for you right there in the front row. This is the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
And I'm the other guy, Jason Howell. Good to see you, Micah. Thank you for holding down the fort while I was out last week. I really do appreciate it. It was a fantastic vacation, so...
I am glad. I'm happy for you. And I'm glad we're back both together here today to do this show.
That's right. Filled with interviews and stories of the week that have to do with AI. Basically, that's how today shook out. But let's chat with our first guest here. Big changes in the air for traditional cable internet companies. And a lot of people are saying, including myself, it's about time. Apparently, 5G is the reason why. So 5G finally having its moment. Joining us to talk about a big paradigm shift that seems to be happening for internet in the home is Jared Newman from Fast Company. Welcome to the show, Jared.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Important story because, man, the story for years has been about how a few select companies in all sorts of markets around the country dominate when it comes to home internet. And so as a result, you know, speeds in the U.S. are slower than maybe they are in other parts of the world. Prices are higher, all this kind of stuff. So talk a little bit, first of all, before we kind of get into the newsy part of this, what we've all endured so far. How have legacy cable companies like Comcast, like Charter, how have they been able to thrive so much and offer so little in the past however many years?
Yeah, well, you know, cable internet is expensive to build out. It's not easy. And, you know, wiring up everybody's homes, that is a challenge. But at the same time, the big cable companies have also clearly been mindful not to step on each other's toes. They like having these regional monopolies or duopolies, and they've lobbied to hinder competition from, you know, municipal broadband or rules that might make it easier for other companies to come in. So they've done a pretty good job shutting out competition on top of just having built out these networks. And so you know how it goes. The company wants to raise prices or implement data caps. Oftentimes, there's not that much you can do. There was a report a couple of years ago. Most Americans have only one choice of high-speed broadband. Maybe the other choice is like DSL or something like that, if you're lucky. And it's just a bad situation all around. And, you know, speeds are okay. Speeds have gotten pretty good, but it's kind of like the speeds have gone up, but the price has gone up, and you don't really have much choice over that. They've really pushed gigabit internet speeds, whether you need them or not, or something close to that. And so if you want a low cost option, it's just not even there.
Yeah, totally. And it really seems like there are these alternative methods that are popping up, you know, satellite, and of course, what we're going to be talking about here, 5G. Comcast and Charter showing their first ever declines in the internet business, which is incredibly notable. What are they sharing as the big reason behind those declines? How are they talking about this?
Yeah, so Comcast is basically flat. I think Charter may have declined a little bit. And, you know, they cite a wide range of factors, the end of the pandemic, all this stuff. But you look at the Comcast earnings call, and they do sort of begrudgingly admit that what they call fixed wireless broadband has been a factor. Increased competition was what they actually said. Brian Roberts, CEO of Comcast, calling it a, I put this here, temporary opportunity targeted at value-oriented customers, which, of course, is the same thing that they said about cord cutting. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, right. See how that pans out for them. So then, who are the companies that are, you know, stand to benefit from this? It seems, and this is exactly what you wrote about, Verizon, T-Mobile, both offering in-home internet and 5G kind of behind this. So, first of all, how prevalent is this? Because like I haven't been in the market to look for replacement options for my own home internet. I also probably have different needs compared to the average user. But how widespread is this like 5G offering here in the U.S. for people powering their home's internet?
It's pretty early days. I think it's somewhere around. Look it up. T-Mobile was maybe in the million customer range and Verizon less than that. So it's early and they really only have just started kind of ramping up the marketing. T-Mobile had a Super Bowl ad earlier this year. But like, you know, until this year, they were just sort of building it out. You couldn't really get it. They've only recently just started expanding it to more markets and talking about it more. So it's not super prevalent yet, but I think you're going to start hearing about it more. In terms of what it offers, it's cheaper. You know, T-Mobile and Verizon are both charging $50 a month. Verizon, even if you're a Verizon wireless subscriber, you can bundle for $25 a month extra. And so you have Spectrum, $75 a month, which they charge everywhere. And Comcast is often, I think, without a promo, it's like $99 a month for internet. So, it's just cheaper. Maybe it's not quite as fast, but it's a lot cheaper, especially over time.
Yeah, the not quite as fast is one aspect that I think is interesting, right? Because what we've seen with companies like Comcast and Charter, we've seen them leaning into is, yeah, but we can run fiber to your home, or we can, you know, offer you these insane speeds. And you kind of touch on this a little bit in your article, that like the everyday user probably doesn't benefit a whole lot from that. Like, you know, how many everyday users are downloading, you know, 4K video streams simultaneously, you know, throughout their home? Not that many. So I don't know. Like, I guess that kind of diminishes a little bit what I have thought is a core kind of competency or core value of the cable internet companies, which is this high speed. Not everybody needs that. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, to your point, even if you were downloading 5K video streams, that's like, what, 125 megabits per second? And so, You know, T-Mobile's maximum speeds do meet that. You would need something like 40 Netflix streams at 4K, which you can't even get, you know, you need multiple Netflix subscriptions. It really is overkill. And it's funny because the cable companies, their marketing is sort of, it's a little sleazy to me. They make it seem, you know, you look at their pages where they advertise gigabit internet, and they're like, well, if you need to multitask, you really need gigabit. And it's like, no, that's not even close. So again, it's kind of like a matter of, if you can come in with something that's good enough and it's way cheaper, as long as you can get over like whatever mental hurdle the cable companies have created about needing high speed, I think it could be good enough.
Yeah. So then, okay, so it's cheaper. What are like, how comparable are the speeds to like the standard offering that most customers, you know, are getting through their cable internet. I don't know if that's 100 megabits down. It's probably less than that, actually, nationwide, unfortunately. But comparatively speaking, in these markets that are offering this 5G home internet, what are those customers looking at? Is there any difference in like things like latency and like other downsides that that is the trade-off there?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be somewhat realistic about this. I think T-Mobile advertises speeds up to 182 megabits per second, and Verizon is maybe there's been some tests showing up to 300 megabits per second. So, you know, it's not fiber, but like we were saying, it's good enough. In terms of reliability, I think that is a bit of a question mark. And latency, if you're trying to do online gaming, maybe it isn't going to be for you. But again, it's like there's so many people that don't need all that. I think the challenge is going to be, can they expand the service without sort of adversely affecting, keep in mind, not just other home internet subscribers, but it's the same airwaves as mobile, and mobile subscribers do pay more. You know, those are the lucrative customers, so you don't want to ruin the experience for them. But, you know, I think there's room, and T-Mobile is saying that they can hit 7 to 8 million customers in the next 3 years or something like that. So assuming that they're not lying, I think they probably have a way where they can make it work for everybody and not have it be god awful in terms of experience.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that. Sharing the bandwidth, sharing the airwaves or the frequencies with mobile users is a really big kind of question mark as far as how that, you know, might actually impact things. But what this does is this, and again, you point this out in your article, this increases competition. Which competition, as we know, is very good for the consumer. So cable operators have to imagine, you know, as this becomes more and more prevalent, as they start to see their bottom line kind of shrinking as a result, they're going to have to stay competitive with this in order to keep up and keep people over. What if you had to guess, what do you, I mean, is that lower prices? It's probably not faster speeds at this point because they're already offering gigabit internet. But yeah, it's probably just lower prices, right? Or are there other ways that they can incentivize?
Yeah, the thing to keep in mind right now is like what Comcast has said is, so far at least, they're not seeing people abandon their service for these newer offerings. But it's new customers, you know, and that's been the growth story for cable companies all these years. You know, TV subscriptions are plummeting because cord cutting is a huge thing, and they've kind of given up on retaining TV subscribers. And they're saying, well, look, you know, as long as we're growing internet, it's going to be fine. But at least as of last quarter, they're not growing internet anymore. So they're going to have to do more to earn those new customers than they had been. I think that could be, you know, we may see a return to some lower cost options that they had kind of gotten away from, or they may get more aggressive in offering promotions, you know, deeper promotional rates just to get people in the door. I'm kind of hoping that they take another look at data caps, which at least especially for wired internet is technically unnecessary and is just a revenue opportunity. So I'm hoping that they take a fresh look at that and realize that that's probably their biggest competitive advantage. Whether they actually do, you know, we'll have to see.
Yeah, yeah. And then finally, I'm kind of left with this thought that 5G as, you know, a connectivity standard, the last, where are we at now? Two or three years has been, you know, the kind of messaging around it is like, this is the next big thing. You want your phones to be with 5G. And now, of course, obviously, you can get 5G in the home and it's going to be, you know, offer you better prices, do all these things. Kind of feels like maybe 5G is finally coming into its own, or at least finally living up to, in certain aspects of technology, its potential. And I guess that's good for 5G going forward. But we've got a lot to look forward to. How do you feel about the potential of 5G and what this means for the technology?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all sort of knew, no matter what the carrier said, that the use cases on your phone, like you already, like 4G was fine. You didn't need faster internet to stream Netflix or what have you. And then they pushed these things like AI and edge computing and VR, and all that stuff is like kind of murky and it's unclear if anybody wants it and what it's going to be. And as you know, obviously all that stuff just ended up being a lot farther out or may not even materialize at all. And meanwhile, you have this thing that's just easy money. You have excess capacity and demand, right? Like it's not a demand problem. Nobody's sitting there being like, oh, I'm totally happy with cable internet. I mean, maybe some people, but like, I think we're all looking for more competition. And so, I think the challenge now is not finding people to sign up. It's meeting the demand for it.
Yes, indeed. Well, I really appreciate you hopping on with us today to tell your to give the background around this story, and you know that we can point more eyeballs to your story on Fast Company. Jared Newman, of course, writes for Fast Company. If people want to follow you online, where can they find you, Jared?
JaredNewman.com. I got links to. I write a weekly cord cutting newsletter, so if you're interested in this kind of stuff and ways to save money, you can visit cordcutterweekly.com as well. And sign up for that newsletter. I really appreciate that.
Right on. All right. Everybody check it out. And again, thank you, Jared. And we'll talk with you soon. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it.
You bet. All right. Coming up, Instagram face. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Is that intriguing in and of itself? I'm just going to leave it at that so you can kind of come up with your own ideas as far as what that means. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by ExpressVPN. We all know how ExpressVPN protects our privacy and our security online, but here's something you might not already know. You can use ExpressVPN to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. So, you know, often like a company like Netflix, it has an offering here in the US, but it might offer a different slate of shows. It might have certain movies that are in the UK version of the site or the Japanese version of the site that you can't get here in the US. So there's plenty of stuff obviously to watch in Netflix here in the US, but if you start looking outside of your market, you're going to find lots of other stuff available out there. The Office, Friends, Parks and Recreation. You find that on the UK Netflix. Vikings, Fargo, that's on the Canadian Netflix. Rick and Morty on the Australian Netflix. You almost need like a spreadsheet to keep track of which show is in which version of Netflix. But here's the good news. You use an app like ExpressVPN and you can browse those offerings. You can say, well, I am located in the UK or I am located in Australia. Thanks to ExpressVPN, you can change your location and you refresh Netflix and that's it. You get access to those things. ExpressVPN lets you control where you want sites to think you're located. And you can choose from almost 100 different countries. So you can imagine all the different Netflix libraries that you can go through as a result. If you love Korean dramas, use ExpressVPN to Parasite. See what I did there? Off South Korean Netflix. But it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service. So Hulu, BBC, iPlayer, YouTube, you name it. There are hundreds of VPNs out there. But the reason that I personally use ExpressVPN is, one of the many reasons is to watch shows, in other places is because it's ridiculously fast. There's never any buffering. There's no lag. You don't know that you're running a VPN. And I can't say that for other VPNs that I've used. You can stream in HD, no problem. You just don't feel that slowdown that VPNs often introduce. ExpressVPN also works on all your devices. So your phones, your media consoles, smart TVs, and so many more. And you can watch what you want on the big screen or on the go. Personally, I've got it on my router, so I can turn it on for the entire home. It's as easy as pushing a button. So, outside of the streaming movies thing, if I go to a place with public Wi-Fi, all I have to do, actually in Android, I don't even need to go into the ExpressVPN app. I pull down my quick settings in Android and there is an ExpressVPN tile in there. So I just tap that and boop, it turns it right on. It's the easiest thing in the world. And if it happens to cancel, like stop that connection, data doesn't flow through. So it protects me in case it kind of, it gets, it isn't working the way it's supposed to. I don't think that I'm protected and I'm not. It did that for me the other day. Pretty awesome. So if you want to get access to hundreds of new shows, go to expressvpn.com/TNW right now. Do that right now and you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. That's EXPRESS, expressvpn.com/TNW. And check it out for yourself. You're going to love it. You're going to love watching all those different shows and movies that you can't get here in the U.S. ExpressVPN.com/TNW, and you can learn more there. And we thank ExpressVPN for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right, Micah, over to you.
Thank you, Jason. Beauty filters, like the ones I'm currently wearing on my face, for those of you listening and not watching, my eyebrows, my lips, and my beard are all blue. And these beauty filters can be fun, but it turns out that, well, and some of you may know, there is also some risk of harm that can come with beauty filters. And there seems to be kind of an ongoing back and forth, a bit of a battle, a bit of a discussion about what is good, what is not, when it comes to augmenting our faces, our bodies digitally. Joining us to talk about the beauty filters on social media is returning guest Tate Ryan Mosley from MIT Technology Review. Welcome back, Tate.
Hi, Micah. How are you?
I am doing well, and it's so good to have you on the show. So we had you on the show a while back to talk about beauty filters. And I think that one of the things that was that really stuck out to me in this piece is the kind of technical detail you go into when it comes to beauty filters, because many of us think of them as, oh, you know, we open up Snapchat and we put a dog on our face and you snap a photo, haha, fun, fun. But there's actually quite a bit of advanced technology involved with something that may seem simple. I was hoping that you could start by kind of giving our listeners a bit of a rundown, like you did in your piece about the technology involved in creating these filters.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right that they are pretty technically sophisticated. I think in general, you can think about the filter space as kind of an experimental playground that's actually kind of at the cutting edge of visual computing. So like I said, filters are a big part of that. And they kind of, I think of it as having three steps. So the first thing that filters do, the use of filters, is that they have to identify a face. So they have to be able to see an image or see a moving camera and identify what is going on in there. So they will look at the different pixels and identify, okay, that's a jawline. That looks like maybe it's a nose. That's an eye. Oh, ding, ding, ding. We're looking at a face. So the very first thing is it will identify a face. And then the second part of that is there's sort of a digital mask, is what I call it in the piece, of an average face that can be applied on to the detected face across the camera. So, you know, it really is sort of like an outline drawing of an average face that then adheres to your face. So maybe your jaw or my chin, for example, is a bit more rounded than others. So that mask would adjust to my rounded chin. And on that mask is where the graphics are appended. And so when we're talking about technical sophistication, the ones that really are at the cutting edge are those real-time moving video filters. So even, you know, the puppy tongue from a couple years ago, when you would open your mouth and the tongue would sprawl out and then you could move around and the tongue would stay with you. Those are really, really advanced. So those have only been available in the last 3 years when it comes to kind of AR computing.
Yeah. I mean, when you think of it like that, there are so many ways that augmented reality can be used. And I think a lot of times we lend credence to the ways that it's used in sort of technical aspects of a solar panel company that can look at the roofs of buildings and map out solar panels onto the building using computer vision by being able to tell the difference between the roof and the ground. But these seemingly silly things that we use every day, many of us use with regularity, are actually quite sophisticated, particularly given how the background that we have around us, the other people who might be moving in the camera, when we think about all that's involved in that, it's kind of amazing that these filters are even able to exist. Now, there is a term in your piece that I think gets at the heart of where this focus is being placed. And the term is deformation effects. And I was hoping you could define this term for us and then kind of explain how does this differ from a filter like I was using earlier that put blue color over my eyebrows. What makes these ones different from that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a category of facial effects that refers to filters that actually adjust the shape and the placement of your own features. So something that makes your lips bigger or your jaw sharper or your face thinner, those are deformation effects. So the idea, I think if you were to apply it to the real world, would be something like plastic surgery. So if you were to have surgery that actually adjusts the physicality of your face, that's what a deformation effect is. Now, not all of them are beautifying in nature, right? Some might give you horns that also give your face the shape of an alien, and that's deformation. Mm-hmm. But we commonly see them being used in beautifying filters. So, you know, all of these categories are pretty subjective and loosey-goosey, but beautifying deformation effects are the ones that I really focus on and where the attention from Instagram and social media and activists and creators have been put. You know, are there harmful effects of using deformation beautifying filters online?
Yeah. And in fact, this leads directly into my next question. I was thinking you could talk about the popularity of these deformation effects whenever we compare them to some of the others. I mean, I've scrolled through Instagram and Snapchat's lens gallery and filter gallery, respectively, I think, or vice versa, and found loads of different things out there, having a cat sit on your shoulder or, you know, changing the color of your eyes, all these different things. But it does seem like the ones that we see most often are these deformation effects. Why are they so popular and primed for virality?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And this is one of the kind of core tensions that I wanted to get at in this piece in particular. I've written about this in the past and about the popularity, but I wanted to get a better sense of what this popularity actually was and where it comes from. And I did this by interviewing a bunch of creators. So I focused on the people that are actually making deformation beauty filters. And the numbers and the discussions were stunning in how consistent they told me the reason these go viral is simply because people love them. That when they make filters, and it, you know, spans the gamut. I talked to really talented visual creators, and the deformation beauty filters, they say the demand for them is just out of control. It's so much greater than any of the other filters that they put out. And this is, I think, something that's so interesting about this space is, you know, if users want to wear these filters, which is what the data that I collected shows, you know, we're talking about kind of a social problem. We're not really talking about a digital problem necessarily, right? It's manifesting with digital tools, but we're talking about massive demand. I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions and billions of views and uses of deformation beauty filters. And most of those users are young girls. You know, anywhere between 13 and 24 and girls are the number one users of those effects, which I think just, it was stunning to me, I think, how primed these type of filters were for virality. I had a creator tell me that they could gamify it if they wanted. They knew exactly what filter to make if they wanted to go viral.
Wow. And this was one of the things that I appreciated about your piece as well, is that it wasn't just approached from the perspective of, you know, looking, because you've talked in the past about the harm that this has, but also in this piece, you kind of have an opportunity to flip it on its head and hear from a creator who is, for the most part, pro deformation effects. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that stuck out to me as kind of like, you know, you hear a lot about, well, this is how it can do harm. This is how it, but this person was very specifically saying, like, I get that, but there's more to it than just the harm that it can do. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was, I'm glad that's what you took away from the piece, because that's what I was hoping to achieve.
Good.
I the piece focuses on a creator named Florencia Solari, and she's really talented, really popular in the AR space for filters, but she does other type of AR work. And she was a huge opponent of the deformation filters ban that Instagram had put in place a year ago. There was a ban, I think, from October 2019 to August 2020. And that banned all of those type of deformation effects like I was speaking about. And she was a huge opponent of it. But she also is incredibly thoughtful about the impact of, you know, beautifying deformation filters that she makes, and incredibly thoughtful about responsible use of filters and what digital beauty is. And I think, you know, I wanted to highlight that perspective because one thing that filters allow us to do is try on these different personalities and different means of self-expression. And that can happen in a whole host of things. And I've talked to a handful of users who've said, filters have been a huge positive force in my life. They've helped me become imaginative. They're playful. They help me be expressive. And, you know, you don't want to take away that part of filter use. At the same time, you know, one thing we know is that visual platforms that employ the use of, you know, heavily employ the use of beautifying filters have narrowed beauty standards in stunning ways. Researchers have showed that is true, you know, undeniably true, that visual platforms have narrowed what, you know, accurate body standards should be. They have, you know, really put pressure on the mental health of young women and girls. And so we know that there's harm being done, but we don't necessarily know exactly how to get at the core part of it. And I think, you know, what Florencia's viewpoint is this is a societal problem, and we can do some things on the digital platform to mitigate some of those harms, but it has to come from who we are as people. And one thing I thought a lot about in this piece was the kind of lack of examples that, you know, young girls in particular have of healthy digital beauty. You know, I think of myself and my role models for beauty and confidence and self-image. And those came from, you know, my mom and older women in my life who had, you know, showing me a healthy version of beauty. And, you know, young girls today don't really have that. They don't have, you know, moms who grew up expressing themselves online. And so I think it's just this really interesting place that we are in society where we're trying to figure out how do we use this thing responsibly and minimize harm while also realizing that we're at this place in the world and these filters aren't going away.
Right. And in fact, as you briefly touched on it there, Instagram/Meta had originally banned many of these deformation effects. Could you tell us what has changed that some of them / many of them are allowed again?
Yeah, exactly. So they basically reinstated the use of deformation filters, but have banned what they call those that encourage plastic surgery. And it's not really clear what that means. And creators have told me that, you know, the enforcement of it is also not perfect. And I don't think that's a surprise. We look at content moderation in general, and it's not perfect. We don't have a perfect way to do it. So I think this, you know, what they're getting at is filters that have surgical lines or show, okay, this is what your face would look like if it was perfectly symmetrical. Ones that are kind of really pointed at, you know, changing your face shape and encouraging plastic surgery. That's what Instagram is trying to get away from. And they say that they do this through, you know, AI systems and through human moderators. But I think, you know, medium success probably in terms of how that's being done according to creators. But they've also released some features, and I'm speaking about Meta specifically, that are targeted at minimizing the harmful effects on young girls' mental health and body image. So they've done a lot more to encourage labeling. They've done more to discourage kind of those holes that you can get into where you, you know, click on, you know, maybe it's a fitness influencer and then the next fitness influencer. And then, you know, 2 hours in, you're still looking at, you know, they'll have pop-ups and So they're working on features, I think, to mitigate some of that. But at the same time, the lack of transparency is still pretty stunning. And the lack of research that I think can be enabled in this space that's being hindered because we don't have data is a big issue.
Yeah, it's often so surprising to me the way that technology kind of moves forward, where all of the necessary things we need to do don't come until afterward. And mm-hmm. in this case, you know, these filters make it all the way out there. And then we go, oh, wait, right. We should probably have some numbers on this. And the way that you had to approach this from talking to creators directly and looking at the partially because of the fact that kind of AR and VR are still relatively new, then companies aren't necessarily incentivized to include the stuff that's going on in those spaces in their yearly kind of data dumps. All of that comes together to make this a difficult field to study. And so I do appreciate that you have done what you can to make sure that all of this is covered. And as I said, looking at it from multiple viewpoints here, I think is incredibly valuable. Thank you so much for taking the time today to join us on the show and to talk about this. And of course, folks can head to technologyreview.com to check out your work. But if they want to follow you online to stay up to date, where can they go do so?
I think Twitter is probably best. So that's Tate Rymo, TateRymo. At Twitter would be best.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
You as well. All right. Up next, we have Jason Howell's story of the week. We're about to get into the AI. But first, let's take a break so I can tell you about InfraScale, who are bringing you this episode of Tech News Weekly. This is going, well, it may not blow your mind because you may have heard us talk about InfraScale before, but I still have to like resettle every time I hear this statistic. It's alarming, the statistic for ransomware attacks. Cybercriminals can penetrate up to 93% of company networks. This is according to betanews.com, who looked into this. And it's not just large organizations. You may have been going, oh, yeah, of course, if the targets are set for these huge companies. No. 46% of small and medium-sized businesses have been victims of ransomware attacks. This is where InfraScale can come in and help you. The InfraScale cloud backup solution provides the security you need to manage backups and secures them from hackers or adverse events. Situations where you're going, I need help and I need to make sure my data is okay. This makes it so you can sleep easy at night knowing that your company will never have to pay a ransom. And that's a big thing. We don't want to fuel these folks who are doing these ransomware attacks. Let's make ransomware attacks an entirely non-viable way for people to try and steal from these companies. If we can make sure that ransomware is not worth the time, then that is what's going to make it something that it disappears. So you can back up and protect SaaS applications, endpoints, and servers, as well as being able to execute disaster recovery on site or in the cloud. Every company needs a secure endpoint data protection solution that's easy to install and manage. And that is where InfraScale comes in because they've integrated with Hyper-V and VMware, which enables site-to-site failover with orchestration in the InfraScale cloud. That means you'll be able to keep those hackers at bay. Immutability is the key word. Immutability, it's at the core of how their product is designed. Your data is encrypted, even in storage, so it's immutable. No one can alter it. With InfraScale backup and disaster recovery, you will be ready for whatever comes your way. Doesn't matter if it's a server crash, if it's human error, if it's a malicious activity, or if it's even a natural disaster, InfraScale is there to help you out. According to Gartner, you're another one of these statistics that's just like, what? The average cost of downtime caused by a local or site-wide incident across all industry sectors is, what do you guess? What? Say $500 per minute? No, $5,600 per minute. And if we do the math there, That's around $330,000 per hour that you are losing because of one of these situations, these incidents that are taking place. Clients and partners alike, including MSPs and VARs, they trust InfraScale backup and recovery solutions to help keep their business running and eliminate downtime and data loss with the most cost-effective enterprise-grade data protection solutions. In fact, more than 65,000 companies are protected by InfraScale. If disaster strikes, your applications, your data, and your systems are recovered and available in record time. Their award-winning world-class support is there to ensure your business is protected 24/7, now with SSD at no extra charge. Whatever your data, whatever your environment, InfraScale provides continuity and resiliency for your business. Visit infrascale.com/twit to sign up for a free demo and see how InfraScale protects your business today. The word of the day is immutability. Infrascale.com/twit. Thank you, Infrascale, for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. Jason Howell, tell me about your very interesting story of the week.
Yeah, I love how this turned out because we both have stories of the week that have to do with AI, just different facets of kind of like creativity and AI, which is just a topic that I'm endlessly intrigued by. So we've been tracking, and we've done this a few times in our stories of the week of the past, the potential of AI-generated art. And I saw a story on Vice that I was like, this seems like this is maybe a milestone or a sign of things to come. Here we go. Vice has a story by Matthew Galt that focuses on a particular Colorado State Fair. Vice probably doesn't have a whole lot to write about, a lot of opportunities to write about the Colorado State Fair, but in particular this time, the State Fair held a fine art competition. And I'm pretty certain you know exactly where this is going. Jason Allen, who is the president of Incarnate Games, it's a company based in Colorado, submitted three art pieces to the fine art competition. In particular, it was the digital art category. All of those submissions printed on their own canvas. So, the requirements had to be digital art, printed out three different digital art pieces onto canvas. One of the three, a piece entitled Theatre de Opera Spatiale, I'm assuming, something like that. There's lots of emphasis placed throughout that, so I'm sure I got that wrong. But ended up with a first place win in the competition. So good for you, Jason. From the Vice article that describes the piece, so you audio listeners can get a sense of what it shows, and we're kind of showing it right now on the video stream. It depicts a strange scene. This is the words of the Vice article that looks like it could be from a space opera, and it looks like a masterfully done painting. Classical figures in a Baroque hall stare through a circular viewport into a sun-drenched and radiant landscape. And as you can probably guess, Jason did not paint this picture. The picture, along with the other two works that he submitted, were generated by an artificial intelligence engine, specifically one that I hadn't heard of, actually, called Midjourney. And Jason posted on Discord about his preparation, so you kind of get a sense of what his involvement with this was. He said he created hundreds of images with a, quote, special prompt. So the prompt is, of course, the collection of words that you use in these AI image generators to describe what you're looking for. And the more we work with these things, the more we realize that the prompts are really important, and they kind of have, to a certain degree, they kind of have, I don't want to say art, but there's a certain kind of syntax that each system seems to carry with it.
And yeah,
the more you work with it, the more you understand what collection of words are really informative to these systems, that sort of thing. I'm not very good at it, by the way, but apparently Jason was. He said, after many weeks of fine-tuning and curating my gens, his generations, I chose my top three, had them printed on canvas after upscaling with gigapixel AI. So he shared this. He labeled it, the submission was labeled Jason Allen via Midjourney. So anyone who actually knew that Midjourney was an AI generation system might see that and understand, but I have a feeling a lot of people would see that and like not know what that even means, right? Just Jason Allen via Midjourney. It's kind of, could be anything. He also shared, I generate images with MJ, Midjourney. I do passes with Photoshop. So he takes that into Photoshop. And then he also upscales with Gigapixel. So there is a little bit of a human touch on components of the equation. But I think the image in and of itself largely was generated specifically from that AI. So, you know, and this kind of goes, the discussion can go in a couple of different ways around this. Part of it lies in the categorization of such imagery. You know, if there is a competition at a fair or wherever it is, and it's just digital arts, this is a digital art. So it's not like it doesn't qualify unless there was a disclaimer in there to say, hey, oh, by the way, this has to be digital art that's created top to bottom by a human or whatever. You know what I mean? There would need to be that in there for it to be legitimized, I guess. Or to kick it out. And I imagine that at some point things like this are going to get that message. They're going to be like, well, wait a minute, we need to put this in there so that real human competitors don't feel completely sideswiped. Because a lot of people were upset about this, and rightfully so. I mean, I imagine if I was a digital artist and, you know, I poured in hundreds of hours into an image, or I don't know how long it takes to make one of these things, but and then someone comes along and wins first place, and then we find out that it was actually created by an AI that literally takes minutes or seconds, I'd be upset about that. What about you, Micah?
Yeah, this is always going to be an interesting topic of discussion based on who you talk to. Like depends on, absolutely. It depends on perspective. And there are so many different points of view when it comes to this. And I feel for those points of view for everyone. I think I talked in the past about how democratizing, like online publishing, the way that AI could help that, where I remember the exorbitant cost of AP and Getty Images, and how, you know, folks who want to write on Medium or write their own blog and just, you know, want to generate an image for that, who don't have the time to learn how to use the tool to sort of create it from the ground up. Because it's like if you give a moose a muffin, or if you give a mouse a cookie, I think it's the ones. I don't know if you've ever heard of those books. But
yes. Oh, yes. I remember those well. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the before times, I want to start a blog. And so I go and, like, I've got the writing ability, but now that I want to start a blog, I go online and I don't like any of the solutions. So I realize I need to build my own blog. So then I go and learn HTML and CSS. And then I realize I need some JavaScript involved too. So that I'm doing that. Then finally I get my blog all written and it's ready to go, but now I need photos. So now I'm taking photography classes and I'm going out and learning photography. I realize that I need to upgrade my camera. So I have to buy a new camera, but which camera do I buy? So I have to learn about the different, it can go on and on and on and on. And yes, of course, the argument can be made that you just don't do all of that and you just stick with the basics. But I like to think that AI can be included as part of the basics. AI generated art can be included as part of the basics, where someone can use it for that. Or for artists who I've heard artists who say, we can use this as a jumping off point. When my brain can't wrap itself around this idea that I'm supposed, this prompt that I'm supposed to be doing, to have some jumping off point there would be really handy. So yeah, I am not happy about the potential for disruption that it has on a market of creators who already struggle to be paid what they're worth. But I am excited about it from all of those other things that I just talked about, and the potential for creativity that can take place. So yeah, it's got a lot of facets.
Yeah. And I think this story really kind of illustrates, you know, kind of another part. I mentioned a couple of different ways the discussion, you know, goes from something like this. This illustrates another aspect that we've talked about in the past, which is just the sheer fact, I think, that these images that are being created by AI are continuing to improve to the point to where they're so good that unless you knew going in that it was created by AI, you you know, you wouldn't know any different. And, you know, it's printed on a canvas up on a wall. Someone looks at it and says, wow, that's really creative. I can't believe you, you know, that someone would come up with this idea. That's amazing. Here, first place. And, I was kind of doing some searching around and searching some Twitter feeds kind of associated with this. And some people, and I saw one comment where someone was like, yeah, but you know what a robot or an AI will never have. It will never have, you know, the emotion that's behind creating the image and, you know, that kind of like human direction that's behind it, that drives, you know, the meaning and the blah, blah, blah. And I was reading that. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I get where you're coming from, but it kind of doesn't matter because when you're talking about art, it's really less about the who creates it and how they felt and blah, blah, blah. It's really about, I mean, that is a piece of it. Don't get me wrong. I don't mean to like, you know, say that that's not important, but I think for the majority of other people, it's really about how they end up feeling about it. When I look at a piece of art, how does it make me feel? And whether that's created by a robot that had some grand vision for a statement that it wanted to make or a human, same thing, it kind of doesn't matter. It's like as a human, if I look on the wall and I see that canvas and I go, man, that's beautiful art. It's beautiful art. It doesn't matter what created it. So it is what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what it boils down to for me, especially is like, if I like it, then I don't care if it was made by a machine or not. It's
totally, totally. So there was one person on Twitter, Omnimorpho, who said, we're watching the death of artistry unfold right before our eyes. And I don't know that I believe that because I think there will always be room for good art, whether it's created by a robot or AI or it's created by a human. You know what I mean? Good art is good art or compelling art or art that is beautiful or whatever, you name it. There will always be people who are very talented and can create that stuff. And I guess the other side of that is if these systems become so prevalent that it's just as easy to plug in a thing, you know, a command or whatever, a collection of words to come up with something that's close enough as it is to pay someone or, you know, hire someone to do it. I guess that poses a problem. But I think at the end of the day, good art is good art and it will always have value. No matter who it comes from. So there we go. I thought that was kind of interesting. A little bellwether for things to come, I think.
Yeah, that's where absolutely.
We're at. All right. Up next, Micah is going to share his story of the week. He's got something cooking. I'm horrible puns today. In Google's AI test kitchen. Sorry. I'm sorry I did that. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV. You can get the best possible IT training to accelerate your IT career from IT Pro TV. They have edutainers that make learning engaging and fun. And best of all, it's on your own schedule. You can kind of do it as you have the time. With their virtual labs and practice tests, you'll always be supported and prepared for your exams. You can actually binge episodes in 20 to 30 minute increments, kind of the perfect amount of time to drop in, check out some content, learn a little bit, and then, you know, get back to your busy life. They have more than 5,800 hours of IT training that is always up to date with the most current content out there, which is important because we're living in a fast-paced world. IT is a fast-paced industry. So you can learn when and where you want on the desktop, Apple TV, Roku, or you can even hit the road. If you got a tablet or a mobile device, pretty sure you do, you can watch IT Pro TV on it. One reviewer says, it's easy to understand why they're saying or what they're saying. It's well explained and the classes are very smooth along with the notes and transcription given. By wrapping their own experience in with the course, it makes it easier to comprehend the hardest topics. They also make sure you feel confident enough to pass the exams. And another reviewer says, best website to study IT and cybersecurity related courses. I like the part where they make a few courses free for a weekend. And yes, they continue to do this. Free courses in the month of September, which we have just begun. It's September 1st today as I read this. They're offering a Microsoft free weekend the weekend of September 17th and 18th. So you make sure to check that out. They're also featuring two free live webinars. What have you been missing in Azure? That's Adam Gordon and Wes Bryan talking about the hidden gems you should be looking at today. September 1st, in fact. And if you miss it live, you can still stream it on demand. All Things Cybersecurity with Daniel Lowry and John Strand. That happens Thursday, September 15th at 2 p.m. Eastern. And don't forget about your IT team. If you have a team, you can check out the IT Pro TV business plan and get your team set as well. Get 30% off when you sign up at itpro.tv/TNW. Make sure and use code TNW30. That'll get you the 30% off when you sign up at itpro.tv/TNW. And like I said, use that code TNW30 at checkout. IT Pro TV, build or expand your IT career and enjoy the journey. And we thank IT Pro TV for their continued support of the TWIT network. And it's time for your AI, a different angle on the AI generated kind of world.
Yeah. So instead of visuals this time, we're doing textuals. Google has its AI test kitchen. This is a place. It's essentially kind of a beta sign up where you can go and join the quote unquote test kitchen and try out Google's AI technology, Lambda, and help to kind of say, hey, these are good responses. These are not great responses. Here's what I think worked about this. Here's what I think didn't work. And of course, that's all subjective. But when Google can put all of that data together, then they can make improvements to it. So you had to sign up. I signed up back whenever I saw, I think it was a Verge article that pointed it out. Or maybe it was even the Google event, but whenever it was, I signed up for it at that point, and I just got access, I think earlier this week. And so I wanted to show Google's AI test kitchen. Let me switch it back over. It stopped screen sharing. So this is, let's see. Remind me again how to do screen sharing on Android. Oh, there it is. Never mind. I've got it. To this one.
Is it casting
now? Yeah, it's casting.
Yeah.
And I believe now we should be good. Yeah, there we go. Okay. So, this is the AI test kitchen, and it's using, as I said, Lambda. Oh, why did it sign me out? How fun. So again, this is all still beta stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But there we go. So there are three different experiments that can be done, and there's one called Imagine It, there's one called List It, and there's one called Talk About It, Dogs Edition. So it's like they knew. I want to start with Imagine, because this is a really fascinating text prompt where you give the AI a prompt about where you are, and it kind of, you kind of tell a story with it. So let's launch this demo and let's think of something together, Jason. Imagine I'm at blank. And be mindful that it will change at to in, because I did one where I was like inside of something, as you saw. So if you need it to be in instead of at, that's okay.
What was the fair that the last place was? Was it the Colorado State Fair? So I'm at the Colorado State Fair.
Okay. Imagine I'm
AI inception.
Colorado State Fair. And then we'll hit enter. And it will load.
The Colorado State Fair is a sight to behold.
Are you able to hear that?
Ferris wheels and roller coasters as far as the eye can see. You can hear the hustle and bustle of the fair grounds. The air tastes like funnel cake.
Wow. Delicious. I'll have some of that.
And then you can start to add things to it. It will actually prompt you with some different ideas. What does the funnel cake smell like? What is the name of the roller coaster? That's what we'll choose.
Yeah, like that.
The roller coaster is called the Wild Whirl. It's a red steel coaster that goes through a pitch black tunnel and has a loop-the-loop.
And has a loop-the-loop.
A loop-the-loop. That's awesome.
Then what does it feel like to be on the roller coaster? I think that's interesting. Let's do that one.
It feels exhilarating. The wind is in your face, and you can feel your stomach drop as you go down the first big hill. Like a rush of butterflies in your stomach.
Oh, that's so cool. And it keeps, so you could go on endlessly because it keeps popping up components from the previous kind of information to ask it questions, or you can just write your own. Is that right?
Yeah.
Can you talk to it?
No, not that I know of. Only in whenever you first type like it, voice then entry. It will. Yeah, it will just do the dictation. But after each of these, there you'll see there's a little section for people who are listening. I have the phone up on the screen. There's a little section that says, "How was this reply? Nice, offensive, off topic, not true." So you can easily go in and say that that was good or that was bad. So that's imagine it. We'll close out of that one. Eventually, that's so cool. It will kind of. Yeah, it'll bring you to the end after a period of time where it's it'll say, okay, whoosh, you're brought back to your home space. So the prompt doesn't go on forever, but you do get to kind of explore with it as much as you want to. Now, this next one helps you to generate a list based on a topic that you give it. So maybe I want to learn how to play guitar, or I want to write a song. So we'll start this one and let's go. I want to go camping.
I was just thinking that. How'd you read my mind? Probably because I am.
Because you're always
tomorrow.
Thinking about camping. That's why. Jason Howell equals camping in my head.
True, true. Okay. Fair.
So the prompt so that I gave funny. Was I want to go camping in the deep woods. So let's see what it says about this. So it says, stash some supplies in your car, get a map of the area, get a compass, get a GPS, tell your friends where you're going, very important, bring some water, bring some food. You can regenerate the list. You can also, at this one, generate a tip. So it will kind of be an added addition. It says, if you're going to be in the woods for a while, bring a map and a compass. GPS is great, but you don't want to depend on it. So I love that there's also tip options. And I have to tell you, folks, I was very impressed because I wanted to trip this one up. So I thought, okay, this is only going to work with kind of simpler prompts. For example, like I want to enjoy some ice cream. And so then it would say like, find a shop, da 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 da. But I wanted to trip it up by saying, I'm lactose intolerant and I want to find ice cream, or I want to enjoy some ice cream, I think is what I put. I thought, surely it's not going to be able to get this. It said, look up local ice cream shops, call the ice cream shop and check for vegan options, enjoy the ice cream. And I thought, you trickster, you did it. Yeah.
That's great.
So I,
now on any of these, these items that come up, like what was the top item? I think there was something like, you know, load up all of your supplies. Could you ask it to drill down further on like what supplies, what are some supplies to bring? And it would be like, okay, well, these are the things.
Yeah. Each of these lines has a little plus icon to the right of it that you can tap on to add steps to that. So I will tap on the plus next to stash some supplies in your car. And it will start to generate, and then it has these supplies: flashlight, extra batteries, matches, and a waterproof container. Boom. Isn't that fun? I definitely gave feedback to Google for the ice cream one. I was like, I honestly thought I was going to trip you all up, and you did a good job, so I'm impressed. Let's go to the last one, which is called Talk About It Dogs Edition. And so we'll launch this demo. And the first thing that happens with this is
I'm bouncing through the grass.
Tennis ball. And I think I can turn this up if it's too quiet.
Have you ever noticed how dogs can recognize their owner's voice even if they don't see them?
And so this is is this the tennis ball that's talking? Or
this is, from the tennis ball's perspective.
Okay. All right.
So you are, in this instance, you are hearing what the tennis ball thinks. And the example that I gave, they can recognize the owner's voice. So then you can say, I have noticed that, but why?
Oh, I see. You're talking to a tennis ball.
Talking to the tennis ball.
Got it. Okay.
Sorry, I'm not sure what to say about that. Anyways, so have you ever wondered if dogs can get the hiccups?
So I guess I must have confused it there. That's a good thing. I can give some feedback. I'll say, can they get the hiccups? And see, I'm saying they instead of dogs. And so the system has to be smart enough to know that I am referring to what it has already sent me.
I think they can, but I haven't heard it before. Maybe I just don't have the right frequency hearing to hear their hiccups. But you know what's weird? I don't think I've ever seen a dog sneeze before.
Okay, that's weird. I've certainly seen
that. That is weird.
Let's ask it what its dog. Let's see if it owns a dog. Do you own a dog? Question mark. What is your dog's name? Question mark. If it says Fido, I'll scream.
I don't own a dog, but my friend owns a dog, and his name is Chewy.
Chewy!
He's a big dog, Chewy. But he's so friendly. I think he has a problem chasing tennis balls, though. He seems to be obsessed with them. What about your dog? Do you have one?
Oh, that's nice. I have two. Mizzy. Oops. Mizzy. And Henry.
What kind of dogs are they?
How
old are they? What are their personalities like?
Wow, I want to know too much. Becomes the interviewee.
Indeed. So anyway, this, as I said, is all just a set of experiments that Google is using with its Lambda system.
Great. I love
that,
it.
That are, yeah, it's a lot of fun. I've been having fun, especially with the Imagine scenarios. I did one. Yeah. I always try to stay on theme. So I did one that was, imagine I'm in the belly of a Chihuahua deity. And I sent you that one. It was actually a really interesting story where the system talked about how you could hear the heartbeat of the deity. And even though it was kind of cramped, you still felt comfortable inside. It was dark. And I asked the what the being's name was. I can't remember what all I asked, but there were lots of different questions and it had no problem kind of using the context that it had and being able to provide a fascinating response that was very enjoyable. So yeah, I loved playing. I am enjoying playing around with it, and I suggest other people try it out too. There's a lot of focus on these image-based systems for AI, but these text-based systems for AI are really cool too.
Yeah. And actually, speaking of that, I completely forgot in my
I was wondering. I didn't want to say anything in case.
I completely spaced that I had some images there, and we don't need to show all of them. But along the Chihuahua theme, John at the TD desk, I put in a link underneath Micah's test kitchen link of Chihuahuas playing Dungeons and Dragons. Before the show, I got access to that system and asked Micah to give me a prompt. And this is, of course, the system. What was it called again? Midjourney. And so I ran it through and it gave me four options and this was the best one. And so I upscaled it and got a better resolution image of it. And it's just like, yeah, these systems are just fun. I'm sure at some point we're going to grow bored of them, but still very neat that you can do that. And I love the Chihuahua theme that that runs through all of your prompts.
That is such a cool image. I love that one in particular. I definitely saved that one too. I don't know what I'll do. Maybe I'll get it printed.
There you go. But, you know, if you look close enough at it, and same with, you know, the responses you're getting from AI Test Kitchen, it's like, yeah, it's really good. But you start to sense these weird little kind of blips that are like, OK, but it's not perfect. Someday maybe it will be.
Yeah, very definitely. No matter which ones you zoom in on. I've got a couple of friends now who are in what's the other one called that escapes
Dolly?
Me? OpenAI's Dolly. Oh, yeah. And yeah. They were doing prompts. And you look at these little squares. And they did them of one person was doing like San Francisco and some different places in San Francisco. And you look at them in the little squares and it's like, oh, that's a photo of San Francisco. But when you zoom in, then you start to see the weird iterations and the weird kind of waves.
Wavies. Yeah. Wavy stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. Gets kind of a little psychedelic, I think, when you.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, we've reached the end of this episode of Tech News Weekly. We do this show every Thursday. twit.tv/TNW is the place to go. If you want to subscribe, you'll have everything you need to know is there. Audio, video links, YouTube links, all that stuff. twit.tv/TNW.
And if you would like to get all of our shows ad-free, we've got a way for you to do that. It's called Club Twit. Yes, Club Twit. twit.tv/clubtwit. For $7 a month, you get some great stuff. Not only do you get every single one of Twitch shows ad-free, which that on its own is pretty awesome, you just get the content itself and that fuzzy feeling knowing you're helping to support the network and the shows that we make, but you also get access to the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you won't find anywhere else, behind the scenes, before the show, after the show, and other content from our Discord, which is the other system you get access to. Discord is a place where you can chat with your fellow Club Twit members and also those of us here at Twit. It is an awesome community full of great people who are regularly sharing their thoughts and showing cool images and all sorts of stuff. Twit.tv/ClubTwit, $7 a month, $84 a year. And I should also mention that you get access to three great shows, the Untitled Linux Show, the Hands on Windows program from Paul Thurrott, where Paul Thurrott gives you tips and tricks about Windows, and my show, Hands on Mac, all things Apple devices. If you want to follow me online, you can do so by finding me at Micah Sargent on many a social media network or heading to onTrend, chihuahua.coffee, chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. You can check out Hands on Mac later today if you are a subscriber or supporter, where I will be talking about using smart folders to help you find things on your Mac. You can check out The Tech Guy on Saturdays, which is the radio show heard around the world, where Leo Laporte and I take your questions and try our best to answer them. And Tuesdays for iOS Today, which I record with Rosemary Orchard. So you can check that out on Tuesday. Jason Howell, what about you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Jason Howell. You can find me on All About Android every Tuesday, twit.tv/AAA. I believe this next Tuesday we're going to be doing a review. I think Florence Ion is going to be on. And I also happen to have the Z Fold 4 and the Z Flip 4. And so I think Flo is going to give her full review, and I will have used them for a week. So I'll kind of, you know, tag along on that as well. So you should hear some hands-on and review thoughts about Samsung's latest foldables on the next episode of All About Android. Big thanks to Burke behind the scenes. Thanks to John Ashley behind the scenes. Thanks to you behind the scenes, behind the camera anyways, for watching and listening every week. We really do appreciate you, and we will see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time.